Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, April 19th, 2024. For the weather outlook today, we have highs reaching into the 50s, but it will be mostly cloudy. Tonight, the temperatures go back into the mid-40s. It will be overcast with a shower in places quite late. On Saturday, the outlook is rainy again, and it gets breezy later in the day. On Sunday, the sun comes back out, and over the weekend, the temperatures will reach into the mid-50s. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For Thursday's midday drawing of the numbers game, we have numbers 3, 8, 9, and 6. The evening drawing that day, the numbers were 6, 9, 0, and 9. Thursday's mass cash drawing numbers were 2, 9, 21, 29, and 35. On Wednesday, the Powerball drawing numbers were 24, 29, 44, 47, 54, and the extra ball of 2. And finally, on Tuesday, the Mega Millions drawing numbers were 21, 26, 36, 44, 59, and the extra ball of number 2. The lead story on page 1 of today's newspaper is headlined, Skip the Cooking. Brand new restaurant and grocery store in Mashpee Commons features hot buffet. By Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Mashpee. A sign outside Mashpee Fresh Market reads 777. Noting that the newly opened food store is open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 7 days a week. What it doesn't say is that a ready-to-eat meal is waiting for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, just like your parents' house, except you have to pay $10.99 to $12.99 per pound here for the hot buffet. There is also a cold salad bar. Everything is sold by weight, with an average meal costing $14 to $18, owners estimated. Each night features a specific dish, from meatloaf Mondays to barbecue Fridays. Corned beef and cabbage is made on Sundays year-round, not just for St. Patrick's Day. We focus on comfort food. We call ourselves Cape Cod's home of home cooking, said Seth Burdick, who co-owns and runs the market with his wife Megan Burdick. Their 10-year-old daughter, Theodora Burdick, is sometimes on hand as an ambassador, welcoming customers, including kids who push the miniature-sized shopping carts alongside the full-size one. Mashpee Fresh Market has a feel similar to an urban market. So many food concepts all in one spot, Kristen Kelleher, marketing director for Mashpee Commons, said in a written statement. It's a perfect fit for the community. The market at 32 Market Street, which opened April 5th, is the third for the Burdicks, owner and operators of Katuit Fresh Market, as well as the seasonal fresh market at Pompanesset Marketplace, and the concession stand at Katuit's Lowell Park, where the Katuit Kettleers play in the Cape Cod Baseball League. Megan said she started working at Katuit Fresh Market in 2010, working her way up to manager and buying the store when it became available in 2019. Mashpee Fresh Market serves the same dinner buffet of rotating choices. Chicken pot pie, pot roast, Thanksgiving and Italian dinners are also on the menu, as Katuit Fresh Market does, as well as breakfast burritos, pastries, and 24 specialty sandwiches, plus store-made salads, including turkey salad with cranberries, walnuts, and apples, for lunch. The overstuffed sandwiches are $11.95. You can also build your own sandwich, or order sliced deli to go from 18 kinds of boar's head meats and an equal number of cheeses. While the Cape has other grocery stores with hot bars and ready-to-eat meals, including nearby Roach Brothers, Mashpee Fresh Market enters a field with growing demand. I feel like there's enough business for all of us, Megan said. Why are ready-to-eat meals a growing trend now? Desire for ready-to-eat meals has steadily increased, fueled in part by the variety of choices that emerged during the pandemic. Total dollar sales for deli-prepared foods and meals reached $24.5 billion in the 52 weeks ending July 23rd, per Circana, marking a 6.7 increase year-over-year, reports the Food Institute, an Industry Trends Watch publication. The idea of a steadily growing convenience food industry is borne out by a half dozen other industry studies of the nation's eating habits. The Burdicks were looking to open a sandwich shop in Mashpee Commons when the former Rory's Market and Kitchen space, 4,000 square feet with the nooks and crannies, Seth said, became available. Mashpee Fresh Market features local ice cream. The Burdicks brightened up the market with green walls and hundreds of creamy white lights hanging in clusters from the ceiling. Then they went shopping for the hundreds of specialty products that fill the store. There were so many freezers, Seth said. I love ice cream and figured everybody did, so I went heavy in that direction. A half dozen brightly lit cases hold ice cream from local producers like Four Seas Ice Cream and Cape Cod Creamery, as well as Crescent Ridge from Sharon, and a sampling of confections from as far away as California. Other local brands include Snowy Owl Coffee Roasters and Beanstalk Coffee Roasters, Pont d'Avignon Breads, Nantucket Crisps, and a full line of products from White Lion Baking Company in Mashpee. A lot of people are excited to know we carry Montelio's, Megan added. Susan Shelton of Falmouth agreed as she settled in with coffee and a slice of lemon meringue pie from the well-known South Shore Bakery. Tabitha Pinkston, a former Cape Cod beer sales rep who manages the store with Nick d'Avignon, said there is a nice mix of products, including organic, vegan, gluten-free, and other choices for those with food sensitivities. Shelton said she was looking forward to trying something from the shelves of Asian cook-at-home products. We would still buy our staples at the grocery store, but we would come by for a treat or unusual things that we can't find anyplace else, she said. Board pushes fire station property decision to fall. By Paul Gately, special to the Times. Dateline Bourne. The select board has put off until a fall town meeting a decision on whether the town should remove from state environmental protection a piece of land on Shore Road that officials believe is the right spot for a Southside fire station. At its April 9th meeting, board members removed Article 29 from the May 6th town meeting warrant to give officials time to evaluate the Shore Road's natural value to the town and to find another piece of property to set aside as conservation land to offset the loss of the Shore Road parcel. The Conservation Commission talked about the Shore Road property at its April 4th meeting. Commission Chairman suggests fall town meeting review. Conservation Commission Chair Robert Gray suggested a fall town meeting would provide more time for scientific surveys of the proposed station site and the land, ultimately to be selected to offset the loss of the Shore Road parcel. He said it's likely his panel could not take a formal decision prior to May 6th. And town meeting voters will ask for the commission's decision, said Gray, a panel member since the late 1970s. He said his members would work with Town Administrator Marlene McCollum and Fire Chief David Cody to find common ground in terms of collaboration, sharing of information, and transparency. Under Massachusetts environmental law, the local conservation commission must unanimously approve land removal from state Chapter 97 protection. There is no deadline, however, for a commission vote, so it's not necessary prior to a town meeting decision. The proposed station parcel is protected by the State Executive Office of Environmental Affairs, the EOEA. Should it be ultimately designated by town meeting as an appropriate firehouse site, land of at least equal conservation value would have to be identified elsewhere and set aside as mitigation. That also concerns the commission. Members on April 4th said there is little time to undertake immersive and necessary scientific surveys to underwrite use of the 3.4-acre old-growth parcel north of the Shore Road ball field. Bourne stands to lose even more conservation land. Commission member Peter Holmes said the panel is placed in an awkward position. I think this is a very difficult decision we have to make, he said, adding the town already stands to lose conservation land when the canal bridges are replaced. McCollum said the final town meeting objective is to start the process of removing the Shore Road tract from its state protection. The intended warrant article about land did not involve firehouse financing or construction. She said efforts would be taken to reduce the proposed station footprint. The new station would be designed for 2 fire engines, 2 ambulances, and living quarters for firefighters assigned to the region stretching from the canal to the Megansett line. It remains unclear if the latest setback in station site location will delay efforts to eventually secure firehouse financing. Searches for Southside station locations date to the late 1970s and have been filled with site selection complications. Select Board Chair Mary Jane Mastrangelo says the Shore Road parcel is still viable and not another failed search effort. She registered concerns on April 4th, however, about delineating the potential station tract to protect as much habitat as possible and including a natural buffer to nearby homes east and perhaps north of the targeted land. McCollum insists the protected parcel is the right place for a station. Southside Fire Station Search Committee Chair Wayne Sampson reinforced that point on April 1st with the Finance Committee. This location provides the best department response times to a majority of the area, Sampson said. This is a good opportunity at the right time for the right parcel. The site measures 3.4 acres of the 43-acre tract bought by the town in 1988 from the Episcopal Diocese of Massachusetts and placed in conservation protection. The sale resolved diocesan tax issues with the town, precluded planned condo development, and avoided habitat fragmentation. Cape Cod golf caddies win full scholarships to college, by George Castinas, special to the Times. 4 students from Massachusetts, 3 of them from Cape Cod, have been offered a rare and potentially life-changing opportunity. Layla Baptiste, Kristen Sullivan, Hayden Cusolito, and Kuryanya Nayayan have received the Evans Wiemet Scholarship, which is awarded to caddies from the state of Massachusetts. The scholarship offers full tuition and housing for college. The scholarship program was founded in 1930 by Charles Chick Evans, a renowned amateur golfer from Chicago, and is supported by the Western Golf Association, headquartered in Glenview, Illinois. Initially, the Evans Scholarship was awarded mainly to students from the Midwest, but in 2019, the Francis Wiemet Foundation Scholarship Fund, founded in 1949, partnered with the Evans program and have co-sponsored scholarships for students from Massachusetts. In a press release, Duncan Grattan, president of the Wiemet Fund, said, "The Wiemet Fund is proud to partner with the Evans Scholars Foundation to support young people who embrace the opportunity that caddying can offer them to change the trajectory of their life." What is the Evans Wiemet Scholarship? The Evans Wiemet Scholarship is the nation's largest scholarship program for caddies and works in conjunction with 24 major universities to provide full tuition and housing for 4 years. All schools except Nebraska from the Big Ten participate, along with Notre Dame, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Missouri, Kansas, Marquette, Miami, Howard, and Illinois, Chicago. Penn State and Rutgers, Big Ten, are the closest universities to Massachusetts. Who are the 3 Cape Cod recipients? Baptiste from North Falmouth and Sullivan and Cusolito from East Falmouth all participated in the Sackanesset Golf Club's caddy program. Baptiste will graduate from Sturgis West Charter School this June and plans to study business management at Rutgers in the fall. Sullivan will be a Falmouth High School graduate and will follow his brother John, also an Evans Wiemet Scholarship recipient, to Notre Dame and plans to study engineering. Cusolito, also from Falmouth High School, initially chose to attend Maryland as part of the Evans Wiemet Scholarship Program, but changed his mind and decided to enroll at Tufts University and attend a college that was not part of the program. He plans to study economics and continue to caddy at Sackanesset during the summers. Nayayan is from Ludlow and will graduate from Ludlow High School this June. She had not yet decided where she will go to college, but wants to study biochemical engineering with the ultimate goal of becoming a surgeon. How does a student qualify for the Evans-Wiemet Scholarship? To qualify for the scholarship, students must have a strong record as caddies, exhibit excellence in academic achievement, demonstrate financial need, and have outstanding character. Ken Charpentier, caddy manager at Sackanesset Golf Club, who's been running a successful caddy program for 18 years, said each of the Cape Cod recipients is highly qualified. All of them, he said, are National Honor Society students who are involved in many school and community activities. And working with them as caddies, he can reliably say they are all of the highest personal character. All three started in the caddy program when they were 14 years old and progressed from a Class C caddy, which is the very basic level of carrying clubs and acting as a professional and gracious host to the golfers in Class A, which involves reading greens and knowing the course and, when necessary, recommending which club to use for various shots, almost like a PGA caddy. Each caddy to qualify for the scholarship, said Charpentier, must have caddied at least 100 rounds of golf, and those rounds must be certified by him. That's a lot of caddying, more than 30 rounds a summer. Christian Sullivan. Sullivan came to the caddy program with some experience. He plays golf, so he knew the game. He also played soccer, lacrosse, and hockey at Falmouth High School. His brother, a junior now at Notre Dame, was in the caddy program, so he knew what was expected. But Charpentier said having his brother in the program before him set a higher standard than might be expected of others. But he had a great work ethic and even worked extra hours with outside golf operations at the club. Caddying in the game of golf in general reinforces key values, having discipline and giving 100% effort, hard work, how you carry yourself, said Sullivan. Ken really emphasized high standards and having a positive approach, so everybody gets the most out of it. Although choosing to attend Notre Dame has something to do with his brother's being there, he said his top priority all his life was focused on education. He's extremely appreciative to have been awarded the scholarship. It changes lives, he said. As an Evans-Wiemet scholar, I'm inspired to pay it forward and give back to the community. Hayden Cusolito. Cusolito also has something of a head start as a caddy because he plays golf as well. But what impressed Charpentier was his initiative and willingness to work. When the caddies first start at age 14, they have to sit in a room and wait around a lot to get an assignment, Charpentier explained. Cusolito would show up at 6:30 in the morning with 25 other kids waiting for loops, Charpentier said. Hayden came up to me and asked, "What can I do? I'd rather help than sit in there." Quickly, he moved up the caddy ranks and also worked in outside operations. He's a very, very good student and a very respectful kid, said Charpentier. Layla Baptiste. Baptiste has a very different story, but equally, if not more impressive. Her father knew about the caddy program at Sackanesset and brought her in at 14. She knew zero about golf or caddying, said Charpentier, but there was something about her willingness to work that impressed him. He hired me because he said I had potential, said Baptiste, something she'll never forget. Charpentier said his daughter was the first caddy from his program to receive the Evans-Wiemet Scholarship, and something about Baptiste made him think she could be another. She works hard. She worked two jobs as a caddy and at a restaurant, and she plays sports, said Charpentier. I watched this 14-year-old girl become a mature woman. Baptiste said learning to be a caddy was a challenge, but she discovered something about herself. As long as I can approach challenges with a positive outlook, I can meet those challenges, she said. Because she started caddying with no knowledge whatsoever about golf, when it was announced that she was awarded the Evans-Wiemet Scholarship, she said her friends couldn't believe it. I'm very proud of getting this scholarship. It taught me to approach any opportunity with graciousness, Baptiste said. As long as I take every opportunity given, I can go far and achieve anything. Baptiste visited Rutgers last weekend and said she loves the school and the people and the business program. She said she also liked that the school was close to New York City. It's just a one-hour train ride, which is good for internships, Baptiste said. Five caddies from Sauconesset have now gotten the scholarship. Referring to the Sullivan brothers at Notre Dame, he said, at Notre Dame, for two kids, it would cost about $600,000. They get a $600,000 education for free. That kind of a free ride usually goes only to those top Division I athletes at the schools participating in the program. The Evans Wiemet Scholarship gives kids with other outstanding skills and attributes a chance. It's a scholarship that you don't need to be a top Division I athlete to get, said Charpentier. UN leader advocates two-state solution. Calls on Israel to protect Palestinian population. By John Bacon of the USA Today. The Middle East is on the precipice of a broader war that can be averted with a two-state solution, allowing Israel and Palestine to exist side by side with Jerusalem as a shared capital. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council on Thursday. Guterres's comments came as Tehran warned it has the ability to strike Israeli nuclear sites if Israel targets Iran's nuclear facilities. Guterres said a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis is the basis of UN resolutions, international law, and previous agreements. The current Israeli government, however, has shown little interest in relinquishing control of the occupied territories. One miscalculation, one miscommunication, one mistake could lead to the unthinkable, a full-scale regional conflict that would be devastating for all involved and for the rest of the world, he said. Guterres called on Israel as the occupying power to protect the Palestinian population in the West Bank against violence and intimidation and allow safe passage for humanitarian aid into Gaza. Let me be clear, the risks are spiraling on many fronts, he said. We have a shared responsibility to address those risks and pull the region back from the precipice. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is considering retaliating against Tehran for its weekend missile and drone attack. Meanwhile, a senior commander in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said Thursday that Iran could alter its peaceful nuclear doctrine, and if Israel targets Iranian nuclear sites, we will surely and categorically reciprocate with advanced missiles against their own nuclear sites. Tehran has repeatedly claimed its nuclear program was for civilian purposes. Israel has accused Iran of attempting to obtain nuclear strike capability and has long pledged not to allow that to happen. The threats of the Zionist regime, or Israel, against Iran's nuclear facilities make it possible to review our nuclear doctrine and deviate from our previous considerations. Ahmad Aghatalab, the IRGC commander in charge of nuclear security, told Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency. Tehran's retaliatory attack came less than 2 weeks after an airstrike linked to Israel destroyed Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing several high-ranking Iranian military officers. The U.S. Treasury Department announced sanctions Thursday for 16 people and multiple companies linked to Iran's production of drones used in Iran's unprecedented attack. The sanctions target the Iranian drone program and steel and auto industries accused of working on behalf of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The department's statement notes that Iran's metals sector generates several billion dollars in revenue annually, mostly from steel exports. The sanctions were coordinated with Britain and in consultation with partners and allies, the statement said. We're using Treasury's economic tools to degrade and disrupt key aspects of Iran's malign activity, including its UAV program and the revenue the regime generates to support its terrorism, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said. The European Council also said new sanctions would be imposed on Iran's drone and missile programs as punishment for the attack on Israel. U.S. dismisses Iran's claims. Tehran, before launching its retaliatory strikes at Israeli targets, notified U.S. officials that American military bases and interests in the region would not be targeted unless Washington aided in Israeli attacks on Iranian interests, a top Iranian official said Thursday. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby has said the United States did exchange messages with Iran, but has dismissed as ridiculous claims that U.S. officials were informed of Iran's time frame or targets. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian told the Islamic Republican News Agency the messages were exchanged through the Swiss embassy, which represents U.S. interests in Iran, in order to prevent the escalation of tensions. Iran had exercised restraint considering the regional conditions, but repeatedly asked the UN Secretary General and Security Council to fulfill their duties and confront Israel's actions. Tehran then decided to initiate the strikes on Israeli targets. Israel said 99% of the approximately 350 suicide drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and rockets launched from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Hezbollah in Lebanon were intercepted. Qatar reevaluates mediator role. Two-thirds of Gaza residences have been destroyed or damaged since the war began, UNICEF reported. The war was triggered when Hamas attacked southern Israel from Gaza on October 7, 2023, killing 1,200 people and taking 253 hostages into the enclave, according to Israeli tallies. Israel has retaliated by pounding Gaza in an air and ground offensive that has killed almost 34,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza health authorities. A special State Department panel recommended months ago that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken disqualify multiple Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. aid after reviewing allegations of serious human rights abuses, ProPublica reported. Blinken has thus far not acted on the recommendations. The U.S. and Israel were scheduled to hold a virtual meeting on Thursday about Israel's planned military operation in Rafah, Reuters reported, citing a U.S. official it did not name. The U.S. and most of the world has been urging Israel to drop plans for an invasion of the southern Gaza city that has been overwhelmed by Palestinians fleeing, fighting elsewhere in the enclave. Qatar, meanwhile, is reevaluating its role as mediator in ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas, citing concerns that its efforts are being undermined by politicians seeking to score points, its prime minister said Wednesday. We've reached the halfway point of our program, and regular listeners are aware that at this stage of our broadcast, we move to the obituaries. There is one obituary in the paper today, and it is for Mary Gail Alex. Mary Gail Alex, age 95, passed away on April 7th at Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham after a long battle with dementia. Born on August 1st, 1928, in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, at Elm Corner Farm, to Charles G. Kelly and Hattie Page Kelly, Gail was raised at the farm, working hard with her three older brothers and two older sisters. Gail was a member of the Gilmanton 4-H Club, where she excelled at sewing and gardening. In 1946, she graduated from Pittsfield High School and moved to Boston on her own, taking up residence at the Franklin Square House, a rooming house for women in the South End. She made many friends there and worked for years as a medical secretary after graduating with honors from Fisher Junior College in 1950. Gail married in 1964 and eventually moved with her husband and two children to Rhode Island, where she was employed as a secretary at Brown University and earned a degree in English from Rhode Island College. After retirement, she moved with her husband to Cape Cod. Gail will be especially remembered for her kindness, her extreme generosity to multiple charities, her sharp wit, her fashion sense, and her devotion to the Red Sox. Survivors include her son, her daughter, her grandchildren, and many nieces and nephews. Gail was predeceased by her loving husband of 51 years, James Alex. Services will be held privately at the request of the family, through the Galluli Funeral Home on Walpole Street in Norwood. In lieu of flowers, contributions can be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you to the staff at Newbridge for their excellent care. Returning to the news, we have a sports story headlined Clark, a Catalyst for Women's Game. Hoop star on SNL. Selling out jerseys, helping set TV records. By Chloe Peterson of the Indianapolis Star. Dateline, Brooklyn, New York. Caitlin Clark's viral Saturday Night Live skit almost never was. When the SNL crew reached out to her about being on the live broadcast on the Saturday before the WNBA draft, she was unsure. She knew she was going to be in Los Angeles for the Wooden Awards the day before, and that would be just the beginning of jet-setting adventures. In the end, she couldn't refuse an offer to go on something as quintessential as SNL. "They kind of just reached out to me and were like, 'Do you want to do this?'" Clark told the Indy Star. "They asked me during the Final Four, so I didn't think about it much. But then I was like, this is once in a lifetime. You've got to do it. So I flew there. I was there all night. It was a late show, but it was a lot of fun. I thought it was funny. Everybody told me it was funny." Clark appeared on the Weekend Update segment with Colin Jost and Michael Che, and she brought jokes along with her. Those jokes were directed at Che to make fun of his disparaging comments toward the WNBA and Clark herself, including one where he said Clark was retiring her jersey for an apron. So Clark gave Che a signed apron, as well as him three pointers. 1, B, 2, better, 3, dumb. In that appearance, Clark became the first women's college basketball player to guest star on SNL. Something networks likely couldn't even fathom just 5 years ago. That appearance solidified, if it wasn't already, Clark's place as a catalyst for the popularity of women's basketball as a whole. "I think you could say that, but at the same time, there's so many people that have come before us and laid such a great foundation," Clark told Indy Star when asked if she is the catalyst. "I think now that we're getting so much media attention, playing on national television, social media, I think it's a huge help, all of that combined together. And then obviously the star power in our game now has certainly helped me take off in a way." Caitlin Clark was a once-in-a-lifetime generational talent in Iowa. Now she'll be the same in Indiana. Clark's Fever jersey went on sale on Fanatics as soon as she was drafted. Less than an hour later, all sizes, from extra small to extra extra large, sold out. It even started before draft night. The league announced last week 36 of Indiana's 40 games will be on national television this season, which is up from one last year and the most in the league. "I think that's pretty incredible. It shows the excitement around our organization," Clark told Indy Star. "I think it shows not only how people really want to tune in and watch, but how much belief people have in what this team is going to be. There's a lot of moving parts to put together still, but as a competitor, you love playing on national television." While Clark's star rose, Iowa's attendance numbers went up 81% between the 2021 and 22 and 2023-24 seasons, according to ESPN. Every Iowa home and away game, other than the two tournament games in Florida, were sold out for Clark's senior season, and economists project she generated over $80 million in the Iowa economy over her four-year career. She's the subject of and an executive producer for the docuseries Full Court Press, which follows her, South Carolina alum and 2024 number three pick Camilla Cardoso, and UCLA's Kiki Rice throughout their season. It premieres in May. "It's absolutely amazing," Clark said of the documentary. "It really allows you to understand the student athlete for way more than just a basketball player, and I think that's really important. I think that's going to allow fans of the W, fans of college, to really understand what they go through, but love them even more for who they are and what they do and what they're about. I'm excited for everybody to see it, and it's been a special project." UAW aiming to make history at VW facility. If plant unionizes, it will be rare victory in the South. by Jamie L. LaRue of the Detroit Free Press. Dateline, Detroit. The United Auto Workers Union is on the precipice of potentially making history this week, as some 4,300 auto workers at a Volkswagen plant in Tennessee vote on whether they want union representation. The polls opened on Wednesday morning. The secret ballot voting, which takes place inside the plant and is run by the National Labor Relations Board, goes until 8 p.m. Friday, with the results expected later that night, according to the NLRB and a Volkswagen spokesman. Labor experts say if the UAW wins at VW Chattanooga, it will be a historic and hard-won victory after repeated failures over the past decade to organize foreign automaker plants in the South. It would add thousands of members to the union. UAW membership is far below its 1979 peak of 1.5 million. The union currently counts almost 400,000 active members and 580,000 retired members. This is a defining moment for the UAW. A victory really sets a precedent and breaks the glass ceiling that you can't organize auto factories in the South, said Harley Shaken, a labor expert and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. A victory doesn't automatically translate into a victory at other non-union automakers, but it sets the standard and the momentum, so victory is a huge gain. Just hours before voting was to start, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee and five other Republican governors in southern states with non-union automakers signed a lengthy letter Tuesday saying they are highly concerned about the UAW's unionization campaign, which they said is driven by misinformation and scare tactics. The letter goes on to insinuate the election of union representation will mean job cuts, stating that unionization would certainly put our state's jobs in jeopardy. We've seen it play out this way every single time a foreign automaker plant has been unionized. Not one of those plants remains in operation, the letter said. And we're seeing it in the fallout of the Detroit 3 strike, with those automakers rethinking investments and cutting jobs. The UAW did not immediately respond to a request for comment. But in terms of rethinking investments, not necessarily. Days after union members ratified the GM contract, the automaker initiated a $10 billion stock buyback program to cover added labor costs. Layoffs are nuanced. GM did say in December it would lay off 1,314 employees at two factories in Michigan due to the end of production of two vehicles. GM is retooling one of the plants, Orion Assembly, to build new electric pickups in late 2025. As the Detroit Free Press reported, GM said it will offer affected employees jobs elsewhere in the company. At Ford Motor Company, a supplier issue earlier this year forced it to pause production of the new 2024 Ford F-150 for more than 5 days at the factories that build the pickup, resulting in temporarily laying off about 5,200 UAW workers. At Stellantis, the company has trimmed its workforce in recent months, but the overall picture is murky because it hasn't clarified how many jobs are being eliminated. The company noted that a round of cuts announced in December for plants in Detroit and Toledo, Ohio, was significantly smaller than originally described. But a separate round of cuts affecting supplemental workers across company facilities rolled out last month. None of those temporary layoffs have overshadowed the driving force behind VW workers signing cards on the UAW's website seeking to join the union. The UAW's big contract wins against the Detroit 3 last fall followed a 46-day strike. The union won members a cost-of-living adjustment, the elimination of wage tiers, and bonuses for retirees. Right after the UAW won wage gains of 25%, across 4 1-2-year contracts with the Detroit automakers, Nissan, Honda, Hyundai, Toyota, and Volkswagen all offered raises of 9% to 14% to their U.S. workforces. The workforce at VW Chattanooga was one of the first at non-union automakers in the country to launch its public campaign to unionize, with 30% of the workers at the plant signing the cards in December. The UAW has declined to say how many employees at the VW factory have signed the union cards, but it has previously stated it wanted 70% of a workforce to sign cards before an organizing committee, made up of plant workers, files a petition to take a plant vote. VW broke ground on the Chattanooga plant in 2009 and has invested $4.3 billion in it over the years, a VW spokesman said. The plant assembles the ID.4 EV and houses the company's battery engineering lab. It also builds the Atlas and Atlas Crossport. Its production supports about 125,000 direct and indirect jobs across the country, he said. The automaker supports employees' right to decide the question of representation and the NLRB's secret ballot election, the spokesman said, adding that employees already have a strong voice in the Chattanooga plant. Part of being invested in people and their well-being is listening. Everyone has direct access to their manager, and our plant leadership is right off the factory floor, the spokesman said. Today's Ask Carolyn column is headlined, Does the Right Reason to Have Children Actually Exist? Hi, Carolyn. From what I can tell, all the following are the wrong reasons to have kids. 1. To keep a relationship together. It could make it worse. 2. To have someone to take care of you in old age. That gives them a role they didn't ask for. 3. To make your parents happy. It's your life, not theirs. 4. To copy your friends. That's immature. 5. To give yourself a life purpose. You shouldn't make new people to feel purposeful, get a hobby, etc. So what are the right reasons? Do they actually exist? The only one left that stands up to scrutiny seems to be because I wanted to. But that actually feels like it's worse. It has less substance than some of the others, which I think we all agree are garbage. Signed, Right Reasons? Dear Right Reasons, well, no, it's not worse, because wanting children is an inner motivation, whereas your wrong reasons are mostly external. Plus, to a child, being wanted doesn't just have substance. It's the most precious substance there is. Plus, the parental wanting, too, can be a desire to give love. The wall you seem to be hitting is that children can't ask to be born. So parents are always making that momentous decision for them. Even if you personally are so grateful to your parents for having you, that doesn't mean you have the standing to assume your child will feel the same way. And there are people who choose not to have children for that reason. They're not comfortable foisting life on anyone. In some cases, they themselves feel their parents were selfish in choosing to have them. If your beliefs are along these lines, then I think that supersedes, for you at least, anyone else's right reasons. Either you're comfortable with the fundamental presumptuousness of conceiving children, or you adopt, foster, or don't become a parent at all. But I'm following your logic thread here. There's also the logic of the innate. Just because we have the intellect to override some of our drives doesn't mean instinct is completely corrupt. It's good to challenge our defaults, yes. And I not only want my big decisions to include some moral calculation and situational awareness tempering any visceral drives, but also hope the same of the people on the highway with me, literally and figuratively. So for the people who are pro-life in an actual sense versus an overreaching forced birth sense, here's what I will call a good reason to have kids. A yearning for family life with all the risks, rewards, and wild cards that entails, plus the means to provide for any children in your care, plus a belief the children you add to the world are, for lack of a better way to phrase it, justifiable. Besides verging on self-parody, that last part also is so malleable as to be meaningless. Each of us can define justifiable to suit our own needs. But people have strong opinions, you may have noticed. And unless we want other people's strong opinions to determine what happens in our bodies versus trusting ourselves and our own yearnings or lack thereof, we must also give others room to decide for themselves. Poll results never smelled so good. 5 bakeries voted best on Cape Cod. by Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Mashpee. At first glance, the Chocolate Rose Bakery looks lonely, the only tenant in a neat white clapboard strip mall on Route 130. But up close, the charming bakery that looks and smells like a treasure chest full of handmade baked jewels is just one-third of baker-owner Vanessa Benoit's realm. "We have this and the two units next door," said Benoit, a professional cake maker for 13 years. "7 years ago, we came here to increase our commercial kitchen space, and then we added the store and we added product lines." Benoit, who started out making wedding cakes, now also sells breakfast sandwiches, croissants, Danish, quiche, muffins, cookies, scones, and more in brightly lit display cases, so inviting you just want to press your nose against the glass. "We can do gluten-free or vegan with advance notice," Benoit said. One case over from the baked goods are three-tier cakes, fresh strawberry and also lemon the day I visited. The 44 flavors on the menu change daily for the buy-from-the-case option that sell for $55 and individual dessert portions for $5 to $7. The single-serve options mirror the cakes. There was a lemon sponge layer cake with blueberry compote topped with oversized blueberries dusted in edible gold. "We cater to people who are looking for edible art," said Benoit, taking time to chat in her wedding cake tasting room. "The art concept is not only what you see, but what you taste. Cakes are topped with buttercream frosting made with house-cured vanilla and high-end butter and filled with ganache or fruit compote. My gosh, if you could see my berry bill," Benoit said, "but I don't believe in using buttercream on the inside of a cake." Post-pandemic, Benoit said, the Chocolate Rose and its 13 employees are restarting baking lessons and special events. For more information, visit thechocolaterose.com. And here is the complete list of Cape Cod's top 5 bakeries, as chosen by 423 of the Cape Cod Times readers. Of course, number 1 is the Chocolate Rose, and don't feel guilty if you browse the wedding cake photos, even if you're not getting married. Next is Scapiccio's Bakery on Route 28 in South Yarmouth. Scapiccio's is Italian, from the room baba and Spuckies in the pastry case to the family who runs it. Baker Matthew Scapiccio trained in Boston's North End Italian bakeries, his wife Debbie and their children Angela and Dominic. They offer a full range of Italian specialties, including a Sicilian-style pizza sold daily by the slice. And the Spuckies? That's another word for sub roll, grinder, hoagie, hero, or whatever you call the sandwich roll. Next is PB Boulangerie Bistro on LeCount Hollow Road in South Wellfleet. A French native who trained in Europe before earning his first Michelin star for a restaurant he opened in Las Vegas, according to PB's website, chef and owner Philippe Rispoli opened PB Boulangerie Bistro in 2010. Although he has not abandoned his classical techniques, his business has become a part of the small-town neighborhood, naming a cookie after the nearby bike trail, how some guests arrive, and crafting a roll called the Wellfleetian. The bakery line, especially in summer, stretches around the block. Locals know to start queuing up at 6 a.m. for croissants, but the aromas of baking bread and friendly chats in line make PB as popular as any Cape attraction. Latest on the extensive menu is French toast made with candied orange and white chocolate bread. Next is Maison Villade Boulangerie on Main Street in Falmouth. If you visit Maison Villade, now open for the season, and see big metal boxes filled with dough that looks like it's just hanging out, that's exactly what it's doing, and all is right in the bakery. In his mission statement, baker and owner Boris Villade explains that dough is prepared the day before it's scheduled for baking, so that it can rise naturally rather than coaxing it with fast yeast or high temps. Time is an ingredient in successfully transforming dough into breads. My favorite is the olive or cheese that is crusty outside and fragrantly pillow-like inside. Maison Villade is also a patisserie, with a 10-foot double-shelved glass case where you can inch along and gaze at the pain chocolat, croissants, tarts, cookies, and other pastries. Make a mental note of who is serving you, because at the busiest times, a cadre of servers will line up one to a customer and move with you, filling boxes with pastries from the case and breads from the wall behind the case. And finally is Cottage Street Bakery on Cottage Street in Orleans. Bakery lovers, there is something to be said about knowing your wheelhouse, and at Cottage Street Bakery, that sweet spot is pie. Known for its Thanksgiving rush, customers may not realize Cottage Street Bakery sells pies year-round, including one that combines strawberry, blueberry, raspberry, and peach. Cottage Street Bakery serves build-your-own sandwiches on its varieties of house-made breads, including oatmeal, which I don't see as often anymore, but I think I would try the chicken salad with apricots and almonds, if only for the name, Chicken Dance. Orleans Cultural District launches first Orleans Art Week. By Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. The Orleans Cultural District launches its first Orleans Art Week, full of events and activities around the town to celebrate local creatives and businesses. The week, which runs April 20th to 27th, features over 30 events, ranging from workshops to gallery events to concerts and more. This is just a homegrown Orleans event to celebrate the people who live in the area, work in the area, the creative people in the area, and to support that, Bonnie Campbell Runyon, chairman of the Orleans Cultural District, said. Exhibitions like the Orleans Art Exhibit at Garvey Rita Arts and Antiques, concerts, and outdoor events fill the day on April 20th with the Addison Art Gallery officially kicking off the festival at 4 p.m. At the kickoff, a new exhibition featuring works from Paul Schulenberg, Carrie Ulrich, and other artists debuts alongside art demonstrations, book signings, and music from Natalia Bonfini, according to a release for the event. Each day brings another set of exciting events, like Art Trivia Night at 7 p.m. on April 22nd at the Barley Neck Inn, a ukulele pop-up show with Tim Sweeney and friends at 10 a.m. on April 26th at Sparrow Store, and Story Hour at 10:30 a.m. on April 27th at the Snow Library. Festivities end at 3 p.m. on April 27th with a closing reception at the Addison Art Gallery. Part of our mission is to support the creative economy and the creative people in this town, and to create events that will bring joy to people where they can come together and create, Campbell Runyon said. There's never enough of that. The Cultural District is also sponsoring several workshops, such as a floral pastel class with Rosalie Nadeau and a drumming workshop for middle schoolers throughout the week at the Old Firehouse Community Center on Main Street in Orleans. Workshops vary in price from $5 to $25, and participants can register online with the Orleans Recreation Department. There's something for everyone, from kids all the way up to 99-year-olds, Campbell Runyon said. Since Art Week overlaps with Earth Day, several Earth Day-themed events are going on as well. That includes the launch of Eco Arts, a year-long community art initiative founded by Creative Cape Cod, working to promote conscious creativity within the community. The Cultural District has given seed money to the EcoArts project from the beginning, Campbell Runyon said. For the Art Week event that they're doing, they've taken bittersweet and cut it, and they're making orbs out of it. They're using materials that are invasive and getting them out of the environment. The kickoff is at 1 p.m. on April 21st on the town green. For a full lineup of events happening throughout the week, please visit the website of the Orleans Cultural District. Earth Day on Cape Cod, Clean a Beach, Hike, See in the Whale Film, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. Here on the Cape, we're spoiled by an abundance of natural beauty. From scenic shores to secluded swamps, ponds, and fields of flowers and green, the Cape is truly a wondrous place. As Henry David Thoreau famously ends Cape Cod with, "What are springs and waterfalls?" Here is the spring of springs, the waterfall of waterfalls. A storm in the fall or winter is the time to visit it. a lighthouse or a fisherman's hut, the true hotel. A man may stand there and put all America behind him. It's easy to take the luxury of such a place for granted. But with Earth Day approaching on April 22nd, it's also important to remember to give back to the planet. Whether you're grabbing a trash bag and a bucket and heading out to clean up the beach, or becoming more educated through a documentary or nature walk, here are some Earth Day activities happening on Cape Cod. In celebration of Earth Day, the Native Land Conservancy and the Mashpee Wampanoag Natural Resources Department are hosting Honor the Earth Fair, a full day of crafts, singing, dancing, and ways to lend a helping hand to Mother Earth. The festivities begin with an opening ceremony led by Wampanoag Chief Earl Mills Jr. During the fair, vendors will be on site selling crafts, and exhibitors, such as the Barnstable Land Trust, will be discussing their work and conservation efforts. Performances by Nish La singers and dancers will be held, and a cooking competition hosted by WCAI's Elspeth Hay will take place. The fair is free to attend and takes place from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on April 20th at the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Government Center, located on Great South Neck Road in Mashpee. For more information, visit the website of the Native Land Conservancy. Michael Packard's story of surviving being in a whale is told In the Whale, a documentary by David Abel. The Provincetown Film Society and Center for Coastal Studies are hosting a screening of the film at 11 a.m. on April 21st as part of their Planet P-Town film series. Beach cleanups. In Bourne, Cape Cod Kayak is heading to Little Bay for a land and sea cleanup at 3 p.m. on Earth Day. Kayaks are available to rent for $15 for the cleanup, and participants are asked to bring their own bags, buckets, gloves, and a grabber if you have one. For more information, go to the website keepmassbeautiful.org. The Center for Coastal Studies is hosting two Earth Day cleanups, its annual cleanup with the Friends of the Cape Cod National Seashore, and one of its own with the Center for Coastal Studies Beach Brigade. At 9 a.m., join the Center for Coastal Studies at Beach Point in North Truro for a cleanup with a trash tally starting at 1 p.m. Right after, the Center for Coastal Studies teams up with the Friends for a cleanup at Race Point Beach in Provincetown. Along with their cleanups, the Center for Coastal Studies is hosting a whale walk at Herring Cove Beach at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 and can be purchased online at coastalstudies.org. The town of Eastham is celebrating Earth Day and asking neighbors to do the same. For just 1 hour, between the hours of 8 a.m. and noon, the Chamber of Commerce, Recreation, and Beach Department and Department of Public Works are asking residents and visitors alike to go clean up their little slice of paradise. Create a team and pick a local park, landing, or beach listed on the town's Earth Day webpage and register online for free. On the day of cleanup, buckets will be provided and collected by the DPW. The Barnstable Land Trust is hosting several events and celebrations of Earth Day. On Earth Day, join Ellen Snoyenbos as she leads the newly established Walker's Reading Group through the poetry of Mary Oliver's devotions and along the trail of the Pogorek Sanctuary. The reading walk begins at 10 a.m. and costs $15 for non-members, $10 for members. Registration is required and participants can sign up at blt.org. The Land Trust is also teaming up with the Cape Cod Collaborative Arts Network for a special Earth Day Maker Monday. During the event, participants will create nature-based art pieces to celebrate the importance of the Earth. The event will take place at 5 p.m. at the Kituit Center for the Arts on Falmouth Road and is $15 to attend. To register for the event, visit artsonthecape.org. That's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.